Thanks so much, Tom. It really does my heart good to see all the progress that you've been making, and this fellow traveler thing is a real thing. I feel like we've been living the steps together, and I really appreciate that. Also appreciate Duncan and the Zoom team for inviting us. This is a really cool thing that that happens on these Saturday nights. So I'll start by giving you an idea of how I stumbled into ACA. This is not my first 12-step rodeo, as the case with a lot of people that that show up here. In 1994, I made the discovery that that I was not going to be able to continue my life if I didn't get sober, and it was a desperation thing. I'd been drinking since I was 13 and drugging since I was 14. And I'd known for a long time, almost 15 years probably, that drinking was a problem, but I didn't really hit bottom until I hit bottom. And so my sobriety date's March 4th, 1994. And I dove into the program, lived the 12 steps, and it really seemed like it was working in my life. I really had no urges to drink, but one thing I should have noticed is that I transferred some of my ism to work alcoholism, and you know, I was still able to, you know, it's kind of this whack-a-mole thing. Alcohol wasn't a problem anymore, but these other things kept popping up. But I was still working my program hard, and it was working well enough for me that that I pretty much stayed healthy. Then fast forward to 2017. Very suddenly, much to my surprise, I had a week-long insane obsession with a woman who happened to not be my wife. You know, it was not physical, but that doesn't matter. It was emotional, right then and there, it nearly killed my marriage of 38 years. So we all knew that we were in deep trouble, and the scary thing was that I really didn't have a clue as to why it was happening. This is not like me. You know, I tend to, as some other people have talked about, be a thinkaholic, you know, and feel like if I understand things, I'm in control of them. And in this case, I didn't have a clue. And my the only hint I had was that I felt like it must have been some kind of a 12-step related bender. You know, it just felt like it felt like a drug kind of a thing. And my wife, one of her careers was a marriage and family therapist, and she had done workshops with a guy named Herb before, and he was running a workshop with a guy named Alan, and this was down in L.A. where we had lived, and so we decided maybe that I ought to go see what they were talking about, because they were talking about something called emotional sobriety, And so that was a hint. And I went down and spent the day with them and sobbed through the whole thing. It was was exactly what I needed to hear and when I needed to hear it. Somehow, 23 years in AA, and I'd missed this angle of sobriety. I just really felt like if I didn't feel like I needed to drink or drug, I was probably okay, and I wasn't, and this was why. So at the end of the workshop, I went up to Herb and said, "Herb, do you know anybody on the Central Coast that I might talk to about this stuff? I'm desperate." And so he pointed me to Bob, who is now in Los Osos, and so I got together with Bob, and we hit it off, and he very quickly became my sponsor and introduced me to ACA. I knew I was off and running. Off and running means that I'm at step one, I looked at the laundry list, and there's only one of them that I wasn't sure of that I checked off, I'm great isolator, have an instinctive fear of people and especially authority figures. I'm an accomplished people pleaser. I avoid abandonment at all costs. Anger is just not a functional thing for me, or at least it hasn't been. And perfectionism. I'm so much of a perfectionist that I actually crave criticism in support of my perfection, and then fear it because it highlights my imperfection. I felt like I was responsible for fixing my parents and anybody else who had any problems, and pretty much the whole free world for that matter. I thought I was supposed to be in control, and I realize now that my self-talk was harsher than I would say to anybody else to their face. In my line of work, I used to have to do polygraphs, and it would be just terrible getting through them. And I had no reason to fear them at all, but my self-talk was so bad that that my signatures were jumping all over the place. And I was really ripe for ACA, let me tell you. Things are much, much better now, thanks to working with Bob and thanks to working the steps and all this stuff. But this is one of those journeys where I have something new to learn every week. And this week I didn't think that I was at all nervous about this talk. I noticed that I was making vague indirect comments to my wife, hoping for reassurance, and being surprised and disappointed when I got vague and indirect responses. And had a innocent schedule mix up in a meeting with Bob, and overreacted way out of line what makes sense. I did some journaling and thinking about it, and And I realized that my self-talk was, well, you better make this talk perfect, or you know, everybody's going to abandon you, and nobody will love you, et cetera, et cetera. And so where did this come from? You know, when I was doing this writing, I flashed back to, of all things, a national ice skating championship in 1973 in Minneapolis. That now I was on the ice warming up, and my coach, who was unfortunately was my dad, was coaching me. His method with coaching was, you just keep criticizing the imperfections until there aren't any. And meanwhile, I'm trying to keep my anxiety about not being perfect stuffed, so that I wouldn't interfere with me being perfect. And you know, this is the dynamic that I had with my dad for my whole, well, for his whole life, really. And you know, so there's the perfection thing, and if I can't be perfect, if I can be perfect, I'll be loved, and if I'm not perfect, I'll be abandoned from the next championship. And this is what he did. You know, he loved his champions, and my sister, bowed out of the championship thing before I did, you know, I wasn't good, so this is the conditional love that we just had to accept. So my dad, I'm going to digress a little bit on each of my parents and kind of bubble up what the effect on me has been. My dad's dad died when my dad was 12, and he left home. My dad left home shortly after that to join an ice show before he could graduate from high school. That was his ticket to fame and fortune and love, and he became a star touring at a TV show. Finally, the year I was born, he settled down to coach. And you know, he was distant and isolated, endlessly critical. Winning and achieving were his god and his source of love, and he had an explosive anger. It was very scary and very humiliating. He was a workaholic. You know, he was at the rink 12 hours a day, and then when he was at home, he kind of hid in his greenhouse and did his orchid breeding. And so he was really pretty inaccessible. And he was also a womanholic. You know, I think that he was so abandonment centered, and he always felt like he had to have something going on the side, and not really trust the relationship that he had. So what did I learn from him? To be endlessly critical of myself, judging of other people, confusing achievement with love, having to be better than everybody else just to feel equal, not trusting of people's intentions, especially people close to me. Intimacy is transactional, and true intimacy is at odds with my need to protect my wounded inner child. Not trusting my own feelings. You know, the couple times that I brought up feelings with him, you know, the response I got was derisive laughter. You know, feelings are a sissy thing. You know, well, anger, just, you know, that's scary and dangerous. So, and abandonment, it's inevitable. and you know, these are just not, maybe they were survival things with him, but they sure have not been helpful in my life. What about my mom? She came from a Hollywood family where outside appearance was more important than inside health. She had a very powerful aunt whose name was Luella Parsons, who kind of directed the family play. My mom was emotionally crippled her whole life, and an alcoholic, an addict, and her main survival strategy was isolating. And if you got near, you got in the net passive aggressive forced field, and that was pretty tough. There was never direct honest communication, so you never tell the truth when a lie will do was one of the things that she laughed about. Bottom line from my young perspective was she really didn't want to or couldn't handle being a mom. What did I learn from her? Isolation is a great way of not to be reminded of who I am and who I am not. Alcohol and drugs are even better. Self-honesty and integrity are fictional characters. It's always better to act out my resentments and needs so I don't have to take responsibility for them. It's this passive-aggressive thing. And, being from a Hollywood family, she was really good at it and taught me, too. Intimacy is transactional, and true intimacy is at odds with my needs to protect my wounded inner child. I think that was one of the unsaid bargains that she and my dad struck. And there was a grandma. My grandmother parented me when my mom was unable, which was a lot when I was young. Many of my early memories were at my grandmother's house. She really obsessed on me, and I think that I don't know why it clicked for her. And it's probably because I was a willing codependent partner. She had been my grandpa's maid 20 years his junior. And when his wife died when he was in his 40s, and then his wife's death, his marriage to my grandma, and the birth of my mom all happened within a 2-year or less time span. So, you can kind of guess how that marriage evolved. My remembrance was that they were pretty separate in their worlds. There was just weird stuff. You know, my grandma, like I said, obsessed with me. She didn't sleep with my grandma. She would come and sleep in my bed. At the age of 5, there was stuff there. All her energy seemed to be focused on me in a codependent way. There was a constant stream of toys, food and clothes and things like that when I was young. And when I was an adult, there was a constant stream of money, household goods, and booze until she died when I was in my late 30s. We had a very strong codependent, dysfunctional love relationship, this was really hard for me to undo myself from when she died, and in fact, I've done some thinking about what led to these two sobriety crises that I mentioned at the beginning of this talk. Prior to my 1994 alcoholic crash, the only, my grandmother had died 3 years previous to that, and I didn't really know how to grieve at that point. I was busy drinking and working the other thing that happened was that I was really successful. I had come up with a coworker, and I had come up with some inventions that were making tens of millions of dollars for the company that I worked for. There were people who were all excited. You know, I was briefing people like the Secretary of Defense and Nobel Prize winners, and you know, I just couldn't handle it. My self esteem and self confidence. Finally, my inner voice just was screaming, "You're a fraud, and you're not going to get good enough, and you're going to get found out, and this is going to be really bad." So I drank, and wound up in deep trouble. And then the one in 2017, 4 years prior to that, I'd retired. So I lost my professional work identity that I had. Moved from Los Angeles, where I'd lived for most of my life, to a rural community on the Central Coast. Lost the AA community that I got sober in Los Angeles. My wife became the senior pastor at a fairly big church here. And that had some unexpected challenges for me. And I found out that my mother was dying. I thought that I was doing okay. I didn't feel like drinking or drugging. I was going to AA meetings, but the truth is that I hadn't really melded in with the AA community here. So I was just ripe, it all came crashing in with, I hadn't been in touch with any of the feelings from all this stuff. It all said, "You know something, Mark, enough is enough. We're calling a timeout here." So I got to have a timeout. There's just unending, I could have the equivalent of the AC equivalent of a drunkalog with all the things that happened in my household, but we can talk about those sometime later, you kind of get the feeling. One of the things I learned in ACA was that I had to learn to properly grieve what I missed growing up. The relationships that I saw modeled, I had to grieve that they really were not helpful to me in adulthood. That really has handicapped me in developing loving, trusting, intimate relationships. I'm capable of sabotaging relationships when they're going well because I don't trust myself. This is very poignant to me because my wife has hung in there with me for more than 40 years, and I love her tremendously, and I'm progressively getting better at expressing that love, but it's been a long road. I didn't learn to be comfortable with my emotions or to express them in a constructive, effective manner. I didn't know I had them, which is what has caused some of my worst moments in my life. I'm learning to be comfortable with them and learn from them and be happy that that my inner children of all ages are having them. I didn't become acquainted with a loving, trustworthy God who is had my best interests at heart. I learned that I was supposed to be my own God, self-contained and all-powerful. The religion in my family was achievement. I didn't learn the habit of honesty either to myself or others, and that's something that I have been working hard to nurture. And I've been pleasantly surprised that the consequences of being honest are mostly positive. I never knew that. I didn't learn healthy self-esteem or trust from my parents, and that has led me I didn't learn healthy esteem and trust from my parents, and that's led to missing healthy self-esteem and trust of myself. And that one's, I still have a pretty long road to go on that one. I have done enough of the grieving to get into enough acceptance that I'm actually learning to appreciate some of the good stuff. From my dad, I learned what it takes to be successful, and that's not just material success. There's he taught me to appreciate that sometimes the thing you will be able to do the thing that you want to do by striving, even if you don't see that right now. And I think that's helped me in my sobriety. He helped me to learn a tremendous love for music and the performing arts from the experiences with skating. He helped me to have a strong interest in science, which has been part of what led to my career. Geography and a curiosity about the world, which I still enjoy traveling. Surprisingly, to me, he had a sense of justice for marginalized folks, and that is really, his father's family was Jewish, and I think particularly when he was going into show business, he really felt the effects of that, at that time. And so I think that he's always had a thing for going out of his way for helping people that are marginalized. From my mom, love of visual art. She was a closet artist, and she encouraged my photography. She also was a great cook and encouraged my love of cooking. And she had an empathy for marginalized folks, and I think that it was because she knew she was broken, and so she empathized with other broken people. For my grandma, well, she funded my the start in my interests in photography and astronomy, and she was the one person who I had any sense of really being consistently loved, even though the relationship was unhealthy and codependent. It's still, it's something, still something that I can hold on to. So, the big, I think one of maybe the biggest difference in where I'm at now compared to when I was growing up is that I know that there's a God and I'm not it, and this higher power can and will and does work in my life and yours, and that helps me to know that I don't have to do all this stuff. I just get to participate, and means that I don't have to be better than everybody else. I can be one of, and I can trust that your higher power works in your life too, and we can be we can be journeying together without competing. My religious background was complicated because on both sides of my family it was half Christian and half Jewish, and I guess a funny thing is that, you know, my great aunt Luella Parsons was born Jewish and converted to Catholicism, in the Hollywood world. I think Randolph Hearst wanted that to happen, and she was pretty happy with that. And so the rest of the family had to follow suit. And my mom had to go to Catholic school, which she hated. I turned out to be baptized Catholic in exchange for a down payment on a house for my parents. So, so much for spirituality in our family. But it's in this, retrospect, in some ways it's been helpful to me to not have had organized religion in my life, because when I got to AA, I was kind of a clean slate in that way. And when I did get there, AA immediately showed me that there is a higher power that works in people's lives, it really came home to me. Doing my second step, it was kind of a it's watching it happen in other people's lives. Then third step was, I'll let it happen in my life if it's going to happen. Come on, let's do it. But it wasn't really until I did my fifth step that I emptied everything, and I was pretty sure that that my then sponsor was going to laugh and walk away, God would just go, and there I'd be. And what I found was God's love, and a sense of, do you think I didn't know all this stuff? And my sponsor saying, yeah, okay, I love you too. Not in spite of or because of, just I love you, period. And this changed my life. And I think that that this is the power that these steps have, that they can be so liberating. So, my ACA program today, it's funny, in this COVID year, I have been going to more meetings than I ever did before. It's so easy to dial in to a Zoom meeting, and I just love the international sense of these meetings. People come in from everywhere, I've always liked going to AA meetings and ACA meetings when I'm traveling, because you get a different sense. Well, now we're all together. It's a world community. And my sponsor, Bob, is just a huge part of my life, and I'm infinitely grateful that he has been my AA sponsor and is my ACA sponsor. I think that to me the integration of these is what has helped me to become truly integrated, because like I said before, I can addict to anything, and so it's so easy for me to play whack-a-mole with my addictions, and having somebody to be my sponsor who can walk with me in any of these directions that I'm having a challenge is a godsend. Service is a big deal. Meeting leadership, our IG rep for our ACA fellowship meetings, sponsoring. I'm just loving sponsoring Tom and watching him grow, and other folks. Another thing that doesn't seem like a big deal, but spiritually it's a big deal to have a financial commitment to contributing to our self-support meetings. I depend as needed on outside counseling and medical support. Spiritual workshops and prayer and meditation. I just finished a two-year academy for spiritual formation that's a church-related thing, and it turns out that it dovetails perfectly with my 12-step spirituality, the way that it was done. Regular physical exercise, attention, healthy attention to diet. And that doesn't mean forced dieting. That means stewardship of my body. Paying attention to my behavior and my attitude on a daily basis, and making amends to folks and to myself as necessary. Working this program on a daily basis, connecting with all of you. That's how I work my program. Walking this journey. One more thing on the, Tom has been my first purely ACA sponsory. It's funny. It took me a while to realize to that when he says big book, he means the red big book. I'm there now, and it's been a joy to work through the steps right along with him. It's purely doing the steps from an ACA perspective. So thank you for listening, and I'm pretty much talked out now. So Tom, you want to take it back from here?
Sure.